We're going to open our Rules Committee today. It's enjoyable to see all the people here. I mean, this late in the session and people still showing up. It's always exciting. With that, we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 597A. Senator Metzger can come up while we give a short explanation of the bill by our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. Senate Bill 597A requires non-governmental entities to receiving public purpose funds to include on the entity's board of directors a non-voting ex officio member that is a member of the Public Utility Commission. It requires board members and directors of non-governmental entities that receive public purpose funds to file a statement of economic interest with the PUC. It requires members to declare actual and potential conflicts of interest at regular meetings of the non-governmental entities' board meetings. And it requires annual independent audits of the entity's financial statements. It also requires an annual filing with the PUC regarding the entity's budget, action plan, quarterly and annual report, and requires audit reports and budget reports be made available for public review. It allows the PUC to remove a member from the board of a non-governmental entity that receives public purpose charges if the board member fails to comply with reporting requirements and conflict disclosure requirements. In terms of background, ORS 757-612 directs electric and power utilities to collect a 3% public purpose charge from retail customers for the purpose of investing in energy efficient technologies and renewable resources. The funds collected as a result are used to finance energy conservation programs, develop renewable energy resources, and weatherize low-income households. Based on statutory authority of the Public Utility Commission, the Energy Trust of Oregon, Oregon Housing and Community Development Department, and Education Service Districts are the authorized entities designated to receive the public purpose funds to fulfill the statutory goals.
And with that, Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26. Your committee administrator has done a really good job of overviewing the bill, so I will only be with you for a moment so I can return to the floor and continue to pass your bills. This essentially is just a bill on transparency, and I think it's Energy Trust came through the public purpose charge, as Mr. Watson said, in 1999. I was on the business committee with my fellow Senator Lee Beyer that actually under Senate Bill 1149 that created this. It has evolved, as many of you know, to an entity that is receiving a couple of $100 million a year in ratepayer money and doing good works with. But in terms of transparency, what Senate Bill 597 does is provide for the public more understanding of where those monies are going, the decision making, the auditing, and making sure that just like we do in the legislative process, that there is visibility. The Energy Trust is an independent organization, and the board is self-appointing. Its members are not subject to the same public disclosure requirements. We negotiated this originally with using our own Ethics Commission. It was decided it would be best to duplicate this, replicate this with the Public Utility Commission, also provide some more oversight. It's just a good government bill, and I would urge your support.
Any questions for the representative? Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's late, Senator. So what you're suggesting is that a member of the Public Utility Commission would be ex officio member of the Energy Trust Board?
Yes, for oversight purposes.
Let's not say entity. Let's say
yes.
What entity
yes.
Is which board.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Garrard.
Senator, does that include your Dash 6 amendment that you're okay with?
They aren't his, I don't think.
They would not be mine, so I have not actually seen a Dash 6 amendment. I'd be curious to see what it does.
Yeah. We'll have an explanation of the Dash 6s.
Dash 6 amendment is about half a page in length. It specifies the ex officio member appointed to the board of a non-governmental entity receiving funds from the commission must be a member of the commission rather than a designee of the commission. It deletes the authority of the commission to remove board members from a non-governmental entity receiving funds from the commission and replaces with authority to withhold some or all of the directed funds from the entity.
Okay.
I'm not sure. They did not sign up to talk about it. So.
No, it's not my amendment, and so I really don't have any comment without exploring it further. I would only say, because this is a good transparency measure in the lateness in session, and if this was the language was actually a composite of those who did testify on it, that it may be best to consider it as it was originally amended and sent to you.
I guess the only question I have, have you had any concerns to this point with the work of the Energy Trust?
Well, there's been, Mr. Chair, concerns. I don't know. There's a lot of discussion about it just because of how large the dollars have grown. I think there's a general consensus they do real good work, but there's literally millions of dollars at a time that are awarded in ratepayer money to different organizations. And since the board is self-appointing, there is no public transfer accountability. There's no potential conflict of interest, and some of the members actually have affiliations with those who are receiving funds. I think while there has been other actually pieces of legislation that have been drafted by others about using those funds for some other purposes, this one simply deals with the idea that let's just be transparent and let everyone know who's making decisions, what is the basis of the decisions, and are there any conflicts, and making sure that since it is a self-appointing board, it's not appointed by the governor, it's not confirmed by the Senate, that there is transparency in that decision-making process.
Okay. Any further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We have such a crowd, I'm surprised that there aren't another group of people who have signed up for this bill, but seeing none, we're going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 597A. And we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 597A. Take a short recess. So thank you. from our recess, and we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 386A, and we'll have a short explanation by our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 386A establishes the attempt or threat to collect a debt that the collector knows or should know does not exist as an unlawful collection practice. It adds communicating false or misleading statements to the list of unlawful collection practices, makes a violation of federal debt collection laws a violation under state law, allows the award of attorney fees to the prevailing debtor, allows award of attorney fees to the prevailing debtor if the action by the debtor is brought in bad faith or to harass, declares an emergency effective upon passage. There are two sets of amendments. The dash 3 modifies the list of prohibited actions debt collectors can perform while collecting or attempting to collect a debt by removing the action of taking or threatening to take certain activities prohibited under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. The dash 4 amendment clarifies that the debt collector may not knowingly or recklessly perform certain actions while collecting or attempting to collect the debt, modifies the list of prohibited actions debt collectors can perform while collecting or attempting to collect a debt by clarifying that the debt collector cannot attempt to or threaten to take an action or enforce a right or remedy that does not exist, and deleting the action of taking or threatening to do certain activities prohibited under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, modifies qualifiers for a person to bring an action in court regarding certain actions by debt collectors, clarifies that the court can reward attorney fees, costs, and expenses to the prevailing party.
Okay. And with that, Senator Bonamici, you want to bring Ms. Justin Baxter and Sybil Hebb up?
Thank you, Chair Roblin, committee members. I'm Suzanne Bonamici. I represent Senate District 17, which is in Washington and Multnomah counties. Thank you for holding this hearing on Senate Bill 386 today, which is an important bill to protect Oregon consumers from being harassed by debt collectors. I want to let you know that this particular Debt Collection Practices Act was passed into law in the mid-70s. It was modeled on the federal act, and it was passed with the support of the Oregon Collection Association. And this makes sense, really, from a policy view that we really should have a level playing field for everyone collecting debts in the state of Oregon to make sure that those are who are following the law, and that's most likely most of them, to make sure that they're not at a competitive disadvantage or given a bad name by those who cross the line. And we heard some testimony, Chair Roblin and committee members, in the Senate Committee on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs. We heard from a woman, Janice Tui, and she was called at work again and again and again about a debt that wasn't her debt, and she explained that to the caller. She kept getting phone calls. She had to actually have her employer change her phone number. We heard testimony about George and Linda Thomas, who are senior citizens. He is self-employed. She's permanently disabled in a wheelchair. They were harassed about a debt that had been discharged previously in bankruptcy. They had a $50,000 attorney fee award issued against them, even though the judge found that they did not bring their case in bad faith. I also found a story about a collection agency that was repeatedly calling the home in Springfield of the mother and stepfather of a young man who is deployed in Iraq. They were threatening to have his commanding officer, quote, rough him up, since soldiers are not allowed to leave deployment in debt. So there are stories, Chair Roblin and committee members, about Oregonians, especially now at this difficult time in the economy, who are being harassed by debt collectors. And this bill makes changes to the Oregon law as follows. It adds a prohibition against collecting debts that do not exist if the debt collector knows or has reason to know that fact. And I want to point out in my written testimony that I submitted, according to the National Consumer Law Center, there are a lot of debt buyers now, and they subscribe to this sort of sue first, ask questions later method of doing business. And what happens is that, I'll read the quote from the National Consumer Law Center, they've learned to work the system to win judgments and coerce payments even when they have the wrong person or lack any evidence that the consumer owes the debt. Even when the debt collector violates the law, the chances of being caught are minimal and the consequences are cheap. So, Chair Roblin and committee members, this bill creates an incentive for all collectors to do what most of them do, which is take steps to actually validate the debt before they start collect from Oregon consumers. Second, the law now prohibits profane, obscene, or abusive statements. This bill adds a prohibition against false or misleading statements. This is typical language in many statutes. False and misleading is a well-established body of law. I looked at a couple of other state statutes. For example, Michigan prohibits inaccurate, misleading, untrue, or deceptive statements. Idaho prohibits not only false or misleading statements, but those that have the tendency or capacity to be misleading. And also the Federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act prohibits false or misleading or deceptive statements. It then has some examples, but it says including but not limited to. So that's a well-established body of law. And I also want to point out that these proposed prohibitions do not change the requirement under current law that the plaintiff prove that the collector was acting willfully. That is a requirement in the law that's not changed by this bill. So at the minimum, the consumer would have to show that the collector knew or should have known that the representation was false or misleading. So transcription, things like accounting errors, those would not create liability. Third, the bill changes the attorney fee provision to prevailing consumer. This is making it consistent with the federal law and actually making it consistent with the way it was when it was passed in the 70s. The statutory damages in this act are only $200 compared with $1,000 in the federal act. And without this attorney fee provision, consumers find it extremely difficult, if not impossible, to find an attorney who can help them assert their rights under the law. And I mentioned the case about Mr. and Mrs. Thomas, and Mr. Baxter, who's here, has represented the Thomases, and they have that attorney fee award against them, which is really devastating to Mr. and Mrs. Thomas. This bill would have prevented that situation. Finally, as your committee administrator noted, there is a provision in the current bill that states that violation of the federal law is a violation of the state law. Now, currently, the law says if you comply with the federal law, you comply with the state law, and that provision was intended to make it equal. But there were some questions raised about the applicability and the interpretation of that statute, and the Dash 3 amendments, which I have submitted, take that provision out to avoid that confusion. So I'm supporting the Dash A3 amendment to remove that section of the bill. So, Chair and committee members, it's been suggested that this law is not needed. I heard that discussion on the Senate side. I heard that consumers can complain to the Attorney General or to the Federal Trade Commission. Well, as you recall, the bill that was passed earlier in the session, Senate Bill 328, that gave the Attorney General the authority to enforce the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act had no fiscal impact. That's a sign that the Attorney General will certainly not be able to take cases in every instance or based on every complaint, and the Attorney General cannot represent individuals. And some of you may know that I used to actually work for the Federal Trade Commission, so I made a phone call and asked them how many debt collection cases they've brought in Oregon in the past decade, and the answer was zero. So the enforcement is not working except by our consumer attorneys. There's a few of them here today who will answer your questions about the bill and about the work that they do, and I respectfully ask that you adopt the Dash A3 amendment and send Senate Bill 386A to the floor with a do-pass recommendation, and I'm happy to answer any of the questions you may have.
Representative Gregg.
Senator, do you have an opinion on the Dash 4s?
Oh, yes. Thank you, Chair Roblin and Representative Gordon. Yes, I oppose the Dash 4 amendments. I believe that they weaken the existing law, and the goal of this bill is to strengthen the existing law and to help Oregon consumers, and I believe that the Dash 4 amendments have the opposite effect. Thank you for your question.
Other questions for the Senator? So if you need to go, you can, or you can wait here.
I don't, actually. We're finished on the floor, so I'll stay. Thank you.
Very good. Whoever. Okay. Mr. Baxter.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. My name is Justin Baxter. I'm a lawyer in private practice. I have a small father-son law firm, and we've had the pleasure and honor of representing consumers in Oregon for me the last 10 years, my father going on 18 years or 19 years. When I appeared on behalf of this, in support of this legislation, before Representative Holvey's Consumer Protection Committee, I shared the story of George and Linda Thomas, who were harassed over a bill that had been discharged in bankruptcy some 20 years ago. Today I'd like to share the story of another of our consumer clients, Christina Lee. She lives in Washington County, and she is the victim of identity theft. Sadly, the perpetrator was her daughter. When she learned of the fraud, it was because bill collectors and collection agencies began calling her about debts that she knew nothing of. She did some investigation and realized what had happened. She did everything right. She filed a fraud affidavit, an FTC fraud affidavit, and provided it to the creditors. One of the creditors in particular was Capital One Bank. They demanded more. They asked her to file a police report against her daughter. She didn't want to, but realizing that this was the only way to stop the collection efforts, she took that next step and filed a police report. She provided that information to Capital One. Capital One wouldn't listen. They assigned the debt to a collection agency. She again provided them with documentation showing that she had filed the fraud affidavit, the police report, and the police officer actually obtained the confession of her daughter. Capital One wouldn't stop. They assigned it to a law firm, a collection agency law firm in Texas. Again, Ms. Lee provided these people with copies of the police report, the fraud affidavit, the documentation showing this was not her debt. But they were relentless. They would not stop. And the only thing that ultimately stopped Capital One and its collection agencies was a lawsuit in federal court. We brought a small case in federal court against Capital One, and I've provided with my written materials a copy of Capital One's motion to the court. In the papers, I think it's stark and explains in graphic terms why we need this change to the law. The last paragraph of page 6 of their brief reads, "This statute, the UDCPA, is not intended to regulate disputed debts or act as an identity theft statute. Because plaintiff denies owing the existence of the debt to Capital One, plaintiff cannot bring this cause of action under the UDCPA." This law would change that and make certain and make clear that ID theft victims in Oregon are entitled to the same protections as all debtors.
Thank you very much.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here today in support of Senate Bill 386 with the Dash 3 amendments. Appreciate your time and attention to this issue today. I know that there's a lot going on. From our perspective, as some of you may know, the Oregon Law Center is a legal aid provider. We have statewide offices across the state. Our mission is to provide access to justice to low-income people. Of course, our clients have been some of the most severely hit by the current economic crisis, and in these current economic times, we're seeing a rising set of concerns from our clients as a result of being involved in collection actions. We do recognize and completely appreciate that there's a legitimate need for collection businesses in this state, and we would say that the majority of those practices operate according to sound ethical practices and business principles. But we do unfortunately have continued discussions and complaints from our clients about rogue actors who are operating without respect for those principles. And we hear stories of circumstances in which false and misleading statements have been used in an effort to collect debts. And that has, unfortunately, a significant impact on our clients and can lead consumers to act in their own against their best interests and under the understanding, inappropriate understanding, incorrect understanding based on misrepresentations by collections. Collection agencies. And I guess I would say, and again, by no means am I asserting that this is the majority of the interactions with collection agencies, but we do hear consistent stories, and we think that this bill will help address that, and that there ought not to be allowed knowing use of misleading or false representations. And so we think this is sound consumer protection principle. I also would like to speak just briefly to the provision that would provide for prevailing plaintiff attorney's fees. Our clients are the lowest income in the state. We are unfortunately able to serve only one of every three eligible clients with legitimate cases who come to our offices because we don't have the resources to do that. So there are our clients out there who are forced to rely upon finding pro bono attorneys. There's not enough of a supply of those, and they are, when hiring a private attorney, forced to confront the reality under current law that they may run the risk of having to pay opposing counsel's high-priced attorney's fees in addition to their own. And that risk is simply too great for many people to take, even if they have a legitimate and valid claim. And so we view this proposal as a way of trying to balance the playing field, and appreciate your attention. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Chair Roblin, if I could just add one more thing I forgot to mention. We did have on the Senate side a letter of support from the AARP, and they explain why they support the bill, because elderly persons are particularly vulnerable to the unethical debt collection practices. As victims of identity theft, for example, many are not even aware of the supposed debts in their name. AARP supports requiring honesty of debt collectors and protecting those who have done nothing wrong from being harassed. Requiring consumers who don't prevail to pay attorney's fees of debt collectors creates too great a risk for people who are already financially stressed. This is an issue of access, and the current law effectively denies access to people of limited means, like those on fixed income. AARP supports fixing this inequity in a way that makes Oregon law consistent with the laws of several other states and federal laws. And I also want to point out, I have had conversations, it's senior citizens are typically home during the day, and they answer their phones, and so they are frequently victims of harassing phone calls, more so than another group of people. So that's why AARP submitted the letter in support, so I wanted to submit that to the committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions for anyone here?
Thank you all.
Thank you.
So, Jim Marquis and Paul Cosgrove.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Jim Marquis testifying on behalf of the Oregon Collectors Association and also the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association, both clients of mine, and both organizations are opposed to the passage of this bill in its present state. Unlike any of the previous witnesses, or I believe anybody at the diocese, I was here in 1977 when this act was passed into law, and I helped write it. I was representing the Oregon Collectors Association at the time, and we felt it was important to have a set of do's and don'ts for all debt collectors in the state of Oregon that included not just collection agencies, but first-party debt collectors, businesses of all sorts, professionals of all sorts. It has served Oregon well, but there have been many changes throughout the years that have created problems in terms of debt collectors' activity in this state. One of the most important things that happened was that the Department of Consumer Business Services, who licenses collection agencies, and who had a duty under the law to require that a collection agency operating in Oregon would have an office here that was open to the public, regular business hours, chose to adopt a rule after the legislature granted them authority to do so that allowed most out-of-state collection agencies to operate here without an office. And we went from 200 registered collection agencies in Oregon, or just over 200, to 760 registered collection agencies in about a seven-year period. Most of the new agencies, needless to say, are out-of-state agencies. We felt that the law has always had this right of private action, and that has served us pretty well, and there are a lot of consumer lawyers out there ready to bring lawsuits against bad actors, and they do so on a regular basis, and as they should. This Oregon Act applies to everyone in Oregon collecting a debt. Collection agencies are also regulated by a federal act, which only applies to third-party debt collectors, such as collection agencies and debt buyers and attorneys who are collecting for another person. Under the federal act, administered by Federal Trade Commission, there's also a right of private action, and people regulated by that act are subject to civil penalties as well as damages under the right of private action. So there's lots of regulation for collection agencies, and there is the state act for others. We passed Senate Bill 328 this session, which brings the Attorney General to a position of oversight of this act, and actually the proponents of that bill, who are the same proponents as this bill, told the committees in testimony that it was an important bill and it would bring much needed regulation. I actually hope that's true, and we've been meeting with the Attorney General, and I believe it is true, and we're going to have an advisory committee working with him to make sure that we do have oversight of this activity. The real question here is this bill going to help in the way that the proponents think it is? And like most legislation that comes before you, the devil's in the details. The intent here is to prevent abusive practices, a laudable cause. But you have to take the provisions in the bill in the context of how they interact with each other and with court cases that have interpreted this act. On page 2, lines 12 and 13, we add this general statement, make false or misleading statements to a member of the debtor's family or to the debtor. And on page 3, we make changes to sub K, which is one of the do's and don'ts, about attempting to threaten to enforce a right or remedy with knowledge or reason to know that the right or remedy does not exist. And we add language about taking an action to collect a debt. Now, there are two very important court cases that come to bear with respect to these two changes to the law. The first one is State versus Redden versus Discount Fabrics, and the proponents of the bill pointed out that the standard of conduct in this act is willful. You must willfully violate the act. That's on page 3, lines 31 and 32. Supreme Court in Redden versus Discount Fabrics, and this is in my written testimony, created a standard for willful, and they defined willful as, and I quote, no more than proof of ordinary negligence by a defendant in not knowing when it should have known. So this brings to bear ordinary negligence claims under this act. So if you make a mistake, you do something, and somebody alleges that you should have known not to do it, you can be found in violation of the act, subject to all of the provisions that are outlined in the statute with respect to litigation and now civil penalties by the Attorney General, which, by the way, run to a maximum of $25,000 per violation. The second case that is important and comes to bear on these changes is the case of Porter versus Hill. In that case, the Oregon Supreme Court ruled that the filing of a lawsuit, even for an incorrect amount or for a debt not owed, is not a violation of the Unfair Debt Collection Practices Act in and of itself. The court found in this case that filing a legal action resolves issues surrounding the debt in a proper manner, not duplicitously or coercively. Now, this allows for the fact that the amount of a debt, or even whether the debt exists, can be legitimately in dispute between two parties. and that our legal system can and should be a venue open to parties to resolve those disputes. These two changes in this law, coupled with these two lawsuits, these two changes in the statute changed the state of those lawsuits. The Porter case was directly in bearing on sub K. By changing sub K, probably we negate the act of Porter, and I believe that that's the proponent's intent. But where that leaves us is with a trap, if you will, for legitimate businesses trying to collect debts that are legitimately owed to them. Because coupled with this general statement of a prohibition on false and misleading statements, if I send a letter even to a debtor alleging that he owes me some amount that I have improperly calculated, I could be found in violation of the law of this act. If I sue the individual for $4,000 because I think that's what he owed me, and the court awards me $3,800, if Porter no longer applies, I could be found in violation of this. And again, subject to litigation, subject to Attorney General oversight, unfair trade practices, up to $25,000 civil penalties. That is a dangerous trap for people who are legitimate business owners trying to collect debts legitimately owed to them. So we're very, very concerned about that. In addition, this change in Section 2 of the bill would allow attorney fees only to a prevailing debtor, and we do have under the Act now prevailing plaintiff. It is true in 1977 the courts could only award to a prevailing plaintiff in one of these cases. That was changed by this legislature, I believe, in the early 90s. We believe that that change was a good one, and we believe that the existence of attorney fees to prevailing parties acts to constrain people from bringing cases they shouldn't bring. Maybe they don't rise to bad faith, maybe they don't rise to frivolous, but maybe they really just don't have much merit. And so we think that that provision should remain unchanged. The bill also brings in the Federal Act, and I'm not going to take a lot of time to talk about that because Senator Bonamici's already offered to take that out, which is an improvement, but certainly doesn't alleviate our concerns with the other provisions of the bill. I just, as an example of how we get we can sometimes disagree about what happens. Mr. Baxter is a consumer lawyer, and he makes his living with these kinds of cases, and that's fine. But he has, on more than one occasion before this body, talked about the Thomas case and how unfair it was. And I wasn't a party to the case. I don't know the Thomases. I don't really know Mr. Baxter. Certainly don't know the defense lawyers. It was a case against U.S. Bank. But I made copies for you of the court's order awarding attorney fees against the Thomases and to U.S. Bank. And I just highlighted with a yellow marker a few things that I thought you should consider, because this case is being given to you as an example of why the law should be changed, and I would submit that it may be the very reason this law shouldn't be changed. On page 3 of the order, although the Thomases argued they were subject to harassing and threatening behavior on the part of the defendant and its debt collectors, they failed to substantiate such allegations at trial. Additionally, at no point did either party engage in any activity that can be characterized as reckless, willful, malicious, or in bad faith or illegal. Below, the judge says, although I reject the notion that a failure to survive summary judgment makes a claim per se unreasonable, two additional factors lead me to conclude that the Thomas's state law claims lacked merit. First, the entirety of the unfair trade practices claim as pled was preempted by the Fair Credit Reporting Act, which is a federal act that doesn't certainly apply here, and this bill does nothing to change. And they lacked any legal basis. Secondly, the one UDCPA claim that survived summary judgment was dismissed shortly before trial because it had a stated value of $19.75. And below, the judge says, although I do not believe that these claims were brought in bad faith or even rose to a level of being frivolous, I do believe that additional due diligence on the part of the Thomas's attorneys should have precluded such claims from being asserted. Because the Thomas's claims were objectively unreasonable, this factor supports an award of attorney fees to U.S. Bank. And the judge goes on to say on the other below that he believes an award of attorney fees will deter other potential plaintiffs from pursuing unreasonable claims. There's little doubt, he says, that a potential plaintiff, if faced with the possibility of having to pay the opposing party's attorney fees, will be less likely to pursue an unreasonable claim. Two-way fee shifting aims to protect not only plaintiffs with legitimate claims, but also defendants who may be forced to defend against groundless suits. And there is a reference there to a couple of legal papers on that subject, if you're so interested. The Thomas's willingness to proceed to trial on this claim indicates a lack of objective reasonableness, the judge says. Secondly, the Thomas's refused a $30,000 settlement offer made by U.S. Bank back in 2006. A failure to accept a large settlement on such claims only underscores the fact that the Thomas's behavior was not reasonable because the Thomas's acted unreasonably in pursuing the claim with a de minimis value of $19, and in refusing to accept a $30,000 settlement, I find that the factor supports awarding attorney fees to the U.S. Bank. So, maybe there are always varying views about these cases, but that's what the judge had to say in this case that's being used as an example of why the law needs to be changed. And I would submit to you that there are cases out there that are brought that just shouldn't have been brought. So with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions, and Mr. Cosgrove.
We'll take both of you and we'll open for questions.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Members of the committee, Paul Cosgrove representing the Oregon Financial Services Association and appearing on behalf of the United Financial Lobby in opposition to Senate Bill 386. I won't repeat anything that Mr. Marquis said, but I'd just like to emphasize a couple of points from the perspective of not a collection agency, but a business, one of many businesses, just like your communities, lawyers, doctors, and merchants who collect debts. We're lenders, but everybody else who has debts owed to them are also subject to this state act. We too are very concerned about the addition of the words false and misleading. And when you think of it for a minute and you read those words without the context Mr. Marquis gave, nobody wants to have things that are false and misleading done in the context of a consumer relationship. The problem is, as Mr. Marquis pointed out, the unintentionally false statement, the mistaken statement. And Senator Bonamici, when she was talking about this, mentioned a number of other states have this language, and the Federal Act has this language. I don't know what the other states have, but I do know what the Federal Act does. The reason it's not a problem to have that language in the Federal Act is because in the Federal Act, if you make a false statement, you have a bona fide error defense, so that if you can show that it was an error, a bona fide error, despite procedures reasonably intended to prevent those kinds of errors, i.e., a normal course of business, you're not liable under the Federal Act. We don't have a bona fide error defense in Oregon. That's why we're willing in the Dash 4s and propose we leave in the words false and misleading statements, but change the standard of conduct from negligence, which, as you know, willfulness is negligence, as stated by the court, to something that is knowing or reckless. If I knowingly make a false statement, I should be liable. If I recklessly do so without any basis in fact, I should be liable. So that's addressing that issue. On the attorney's fees, just one issue, and I'd like to point out. The attorney's fees in cases like this are often far greater than the amount at issue, and the Thomas case points that out. The state law claim was at issue $19.75. The attorney's fees for both sides were astronomical. That's why reciprocal attorney's fees need to be in the law in order to make people judge the reasonableness, the rationality, and the reasonable chances of success before they bring that kind of litigation. I, too, would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions for either of these people? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And is there anybody else here who would love to speak to this bill?
If I might, I was going to, Representative Roblin.
Be sure and identify yourselves.
My name is Mike Baxter. I'm my son's father. So I thought, I wasn't planning on saying anything, but after listening to the last comments, I did want to defend myself, and for example, in Mr. Thomas's case. In Mr. Thomas's case, we brought a case originally for approximately $5,000, and it had to do with a bankruptcy that was discharged 20 years ago, and the relentless pursuit of Mr. Thomas over a six-month period to collect that bankruptcy after it had been discharged 20 years ago. We won in summary judgment, but at trial, the judge determined the $5,000 should have been brought in bankruptcy court, so we only had that $19 in addition that we left in the case that we could bring in district courts, and we're beginning trial, and we felt we should continue trial because we also had Fair Credit Reporting Act claims as well, so we pursued that claim. Mr. Thomas, following that verdict, had this $50,000 award against him. He's got a lien on his house. He's had a heart attack. It's been just totally detrimental to his, you know, he's retired, and it's really harmed him bad. And so I want to give some background. That's a very short background, but it wasn't a claim over $19 when we originally bought that claim. A couple other things that have been said. For example, Mr. Cosgrave just indicated that there's a bona fide error defense under Fair Debt Collection Practices Act and the federal law. Well, his firm represents original creditors, and you cannot bring Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, a federal claim, against his firm. You can't even bring a claim of that nature against him. You can only bring an Oregon claim against Mr. Cosgrave's firm. And the thing about, we're not seeking anything other than, I mean, there's no violation under the law right now. If a debt collector innocently tries to collect or sue for more than the amount of the debt, the only place that there's violation is if we prove to a jury that collection agency knew or should have known because of the facts in the case that they shouldn't go after the debtors, then if we can prove that to a jury, we can prevail in the case. And that's the standard for willful, and that's the standard that we bring these cases. And they're very difficult to prove to a jury that they knew or should have known in these cases. And so even now, the standard of knew or should have known, it's been very effective for the last 20 years that this act has been in existence, and we feel it is the proper standard. And part of the reason that I feel it's the proper standard, you know, what I see is I see collection agencies buying this bulk debt and not even bother with collection agents, not even bother with collection letters. What they do is they immediately sue on the debt, and these collection agencies say you can't bring, let's say for example a consumer legitimately owes $4,000 and the collection agency sues them for $8,000. The consumer owes the money, $4,000, so he's not going to prevail in the lawsuit, but they can coerce that consumer to take a default judgment for the whole $8,000 because of Porter versus Hill, which prevents the consumer from bringing a counterclaim saying that it's false and misleading the amount of the debt, and therefore give them a remedy. And that's the reason why we believe, one of the reasons why we believe that Porter versus Hill has harmed the debtor so much.
Thank you.
that's the only issues. I didn't know such a, I'd be happy to answer any questions if anyone has any.
Any questions for this witness? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yep. Is there anyone else that would like to say anything? And we're going to close our public hearing on 386A. And we'll close the... Yeah, we didn't have a work session, so we're not opening a work session.
Yes.
So we're going to open a public hearing on 3331. And we'll have a short explanation. Do very, very short on the actual bill, because we're really talking about something.
Can you go down there?
And we'll have Representative Gelser go down and talk a little bit about an amendment, which I haven't seen yet. So I'm excited to hear about it.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. Members of the committee, House Bill 3331, in its original form, directs the State Board of Education to establish an assessment system for periodically reviewing financial management practices of school district and education service districts.
Perhaps that's enough.
There we go. And with that, Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. What you do not have in front of you is an amendment. I had hoped to bring you an amendment this afternoon, but we don't have it quite in the form that we are ready to give it to you as of this moment, but maybe on Monday. But I'll tell you a little bit about what it will do when we get it. We have another bill that we will have on the House floor on Monday morning, House Bill 767, and this would be a companion bill to run alongside of that bill to make a couple of clarifications to that bill, which will make improvements to it. Most importantly, may I tell you what those are?
Sure. We would like to hear that.
We'd like that. First, we want to clarify in House Bill 767C, which we'll have on the House floor on Monday morning, we wanted to clarify that the amendments that were adopted in the Revenue Committee clarified that students who are currently enrolled in an online virtual charter school are protected to be able to continue to be enrolled through the end of June of 2011, which is the time of the moratorium that is in that bill. I'm sure all of you have maybe heard once or twice about this bill. And we wanted to clarify that that protection also extended to the siblings of these students as well. So a younger brother or sister that might be coming online would be able to enroll. And wanted to also clarify that during that time, that protection meant that the school would be open for the purpose of serving these students, but there wouldn't be new enrollment from outside of that school district, so that the 50% rule issue would not be exacerbated. The other issue that's very important that we'd like to clarify in this companion piece of legislation is to ensure that a charter school that is offering virtual education options that has been approved prior to the effective date of this bill is able to still operate. The way that 767 is written right now, because there's a mixing of talking about the ability for a school that's complying with the 50% rule to go ahead and operate, but it says that schools may not grow beyond their enrollment on May 1st of 2009. For a school that has already been chartered to start in September, its enrollment on May 1st, 2009 was zero, and so we want for them to be able to enroll their students in the fall, and that includes Gresham Barlow. So this is an important companion bill that we would like to pass along with 767, which will give us the tools that we need to make smart decisions about how we do three things. Ensure that students and families that want to have access to online education have easy and ready access to that wherever it is that they live in the state. That we can be sure that when students do that, they can be confident that those schools are meeting appropriate educational standards, and that we can be certain that we have a governance structure that ensures the best stewardship of our public dollars. So I look forward to talking to you about this a lot more on Monday when we have it to pass off the House floor, and then we'll have this companion bill to ride along behind it.
I mean, it's appropriate. It's virtual. So you can ask
this
questions.
This is a virtual bill, Mr. Chair.
We haven't got the other one yet. So, so Representative Berger.
Thank you. Representative. Is there anything in this bill that changes any of the... I don't have... Sorry. 767 in
correct.
Front of me, so
correct.
I'm any of the provisions around who is on the task force?
No. The task force would remain as it is in the C-engrossed version. We made improvements to the bill in the Revenue Committee, which has on the task force now a... I don't have 767.
I know the answer to that
okay.
question. Okay. It, for the
please,
question,
yes.
is there anything in this bill... It sounds like you're changing the moratorium piece somewhat so that the moratorium is reduced for... there's a moratorium on the growth of some schools but not on others. Is that how this works?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, let me try that part again. Would that be okay? So the way that the moratorium would now work, no new waivers to the 50% rule could be instituted. Under the amendment that we would like to propose to you, new charter schools that do comply with the 50% rule would be allowed to be applied for and started. What would happen is an existing charter school that is not complying with the 50% rule would be allowed to continue to enroll the students that were enrolled on May 1st, 2009 of this year and the siblings of those students. They could enroll additional students that lived within the boundaries of the sponsoring school district. They would not be able to enroll during this period of moratorium new students that lived outside the geographic boundaries of the sponsoring school district. So what it truly, the way that I see it, is that it creates a pause, a true pause that protects the kids and not just the children but the families, because children are part of families. It protects the families that are there in the schools while allowing a true pause from further growth while we have the opportunity to have this task force give consideration to how to do these things. It would not shut down any schools.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions for Representative Gelser? Okay. Thank you very much. Since this is the first we've heard of this, we are going to, and we don't have the bill in front of us.
It's a virtual bill.
Okay.
All things are possible, Mr. Chair, in the legislature.
So we will... I don't think we have anything else for this one. So we'll close this public hearing on House Bill 3331. And now we're going to take a short pause, a little recess, while I make sure that my other member gets back and figure out what I'm going to do. I think there's only one bill left on the deal today, so just to keep you all in suspense. So we'll take a short recess. Just to tell you that we are going to hold over the work session on 3313 to Monday. And with that, we're going to close the Rules Committee for today. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Robert.